Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Thank you so much, and it's really great to be here, particularly in such an illustrious series. We have two brilliant speakers so far. I'm going to build on some of the themes that they picked up, and I'm going to talk about free speech in UK universities, what students and the public think, and what we should and then shouldn't do about it. And what we've done is actually a whole series of different studies. So just to run through what I'll be basing this on. The latest study, as just mentioned, is both a qualitative and quantitative study. So we did four groups with 25 UK undergraduate students, five in-depth interviews in the summer of last year. Then we did two large-scale representative surveys with UK undergraduates of about 1,500 to 2,000 on each of those studies, and a comparative survey with the public, the general public in the UK, again around summer last year. And that UK public survey is really important, as we'll see soon. I've got to thank lots of people for all this work. There was lots of us involved. Finlay Malcolm and Constance Woolen on that study. But that follows up earlier work, and this is where it's really important to have trends on this, as we'll see. We did surveys of students and the public back in 2019, which provides the trends that we'll see throughout some of the findings that I'll show you. And thanks to Jonathan Grant and Kirsty Hewlett in particular for that study. But I'm also going to link it, as you'll see, quite a lot of the theme is about our broader culture wars studies, which were a series of very large studies that we've done since 2020, with our research partners Ipsos, Ipsos in the UK, but also globally. And thanks to George May and many, many other people for all their work on that. So when we released our survey results from that latest study, about this time last year, September 2022, we put out a press release, a report on it, exactly the same press release and report to everyone, but we've got two utterly opposing views, depending on the media outlet that picked it up. So there was a group of people who basically said on our results, what's the fuss? And maybe not surprisingly, the key leader in that kind of perspective on it was The Guardian, who said most students think universities protect free speech, our survey finds. And you can find a lot of evidence in the survey to back up that perspective. So when we ask people to what extent do you agree with or disagree with the following statements, free speech and robust debate are well protected in my university. Two-thirds of people will agree with that, and not much change between 2019 and 2022, pretty consistent findings. And then if you ask people, this is UK undergraduates, academics are free to express their views in my university, a little bit of a softening between 2019 and 2022, but you've still got 7 in 10 UK students saying that's the case, and very few strongly or disagreeing with that. And then on the final one from this, debates and discussions in my university are civil, respecting the rights and dignity of others. Again, about 7 in 10 people agreeing with that. And crucially, there's no difference between different groups of students. And there's quite a political divide on perspectives on free speech, as you'll see in our politics. But Conservative and Labour supporters, Leave and Remain supporters, no real difference between those groups in whether they agree or disagree with those types of statements. So pretty positive stuff. And it seems even more emphatic at a more individual level when you ask people more about their own experience. So I'm free to express my views at my university among students. Again, you can see a bit of a softening there between 2019 and 2022. But you've still got 8 in 10 students, UK undergraduate students, agreeing with that. That's pretty similar, actually, to the National Student Survey finding that Arif quoted in the previous lecture. And this is one of the benefits of asking not just students, but comparing it to the general public as a whole, because that's actually higher than the general public. If you ask the UK general public, I'm free to express my views in UK society, students are more positive about being able to express their views in university than the public are about being in society as a whole. And I'll come back to that as a theme. And again, no difference between whether you're Leave, Remain, Conservative, Labour, no real difference in perspectives and whether you're free to express your views. So case closed. This is a fuss about nothing. Why are we making such a fuss about this? But there was a completely different, a chillier interpretation of exactly the same result, same press release, same report, same comments from us, completely different interpretation from different parts of the media. And again, maybe not surprisingly, the Mail Online, their headline for this was utterly different. One in three students say free speech on campus is under threat and open debate is being affected. And the Telegraph said conservative students unable to openly talk about their views on campus. So exactly the same results, completely different interpretations. And the thing is, there's kind of truth in both of those interpretations, as we can see. So there has been an increase in the minority who say they've heard of free speech being inhibited in their universities, quite a big shift in many ways. So it was just 11%, 12% in 2019. It's now 26% by 2022 that people have heard of free speech being inhibited in their own university. And there's a bit more, starting to see a bit more of a difference between different political perspectives here, particularly Leave supporters, interestingly, which is kind of backed up in our qualitative work. Leave supporters saying unable to express their views in university. And students increasingly report that controversial speakers are being avoided in their university too. So students avoid inviting controversial speakers to my university because of difficulty in getting those events agreed. That's increased too. We're now up to nearly half of students saying that, from about 4 in 10 in 2019. And again, more of a difference. Starting to see more of a difference between the different political perspectives, with Conservative and Leave supporters much more likely to say that than Labour and Remain supporters. So the thing to notice about these types of questions, as they're things that people have heard rather than they've experienced. These are more sort of things that are focused on the general environment within universities. And you can see that in the threat question as well. This is a general question about how threatened, if at all, do you think each of the following freedoms are in your university? We asked about a range of different sorts of freedoms, but just picking out free speech. This is the finding that gives the headline to the Daily Mail findings, which is up to a third now of UK undergraduate students think that it's very or fairly threatened. Free speech is very or fairly threatened in their university. Again, up quite significantly from 2019. And again, this is a survey of undergraduate students, but we also asked them about how threatened free speech was in society as a whole. And really important here to see that students think it's much more threatened in society as a whole than it is in their university. So this is a context effect, the importance of how we're shifting in broader cultural norms and concerns across the undergraduate students as well as the public as a whole, really important to keep in mind. And then finally in this bit, there is increasing fear of disagreement with peers in university. This is not a general question. This is not about whether you think it's threatened generally or whether you've heard of things going wrong on free speech. This is some people's individual interpretation of how they feel. I feel unable to express my views in my university because I'm scared of disagreeing with my peers. Quite a big jump again, up to 44% of people agreeing with that when it was only 25% back in 2019. And these are big shifts in relatively small periods of time. And we have got a public comparison on that too. And now you can see the public are more or less in line with UK undergraduate students, talking about society. So they were asked, I feel unable to express my views in UK society because I'm scared of disagreeing with my peers. And it's actually very similar between UK undergraduate students and the public as a whole. So in some ways, that's evidence of actually we're making too much fuss, but it's also, I think, really important that we should have higher ambition for universities as key sites for civil disagreement. I don't think it's case closed if we've got a similar sort of pattern among UK university students as we see among the public. I don't think that should give us much comfort, because universities should be about testing new ideas and taking those taking controversial views on board. So one of the key questions that we try to answer in this is, are these shifts caused by changes in student perspectives or that different context that you can see across the findings? And here, I think it's really useful to bring in this framework, a kind of social science framework of age, period, and cohort effects. So age effects are when people change as they age. So as we go through different life stages, we change our views and our behaviours as we go into education, leave education, get a job, get married, have kids, retire. All of those types of things have an effect on people, and your views change. So young people's views tend to be different from older people's views because of that type of life experience. But you also have period effects, where something happens in the environment and everyone changes. And that can be big things like pandemics or economic crises, or it can be the small kind of gradual changes in fashions and norms. And then you have cohort effects, which are where one generation is different from another generation because they were brought up in a different environment, and they stay different throughout their life stages. And that's true generational effects, where you're seeing something different between generations that kind of sticks with them. And here's a plug for my book on this. So this is explained in much more lucid detail in this book, Generations. But I think it's really important for understanding where we go wrong and misinterpret some of these things around free speech in universities and the culture wars more generally. People mix up age, period, and cohort effects. Age, period, and cohort effects explain all change in society. It's either age, period, or cohort effects. But we're always messing up the difference between the two. So to try to understand a bit more of that, this is where these sorts of surveys that compare undergraduate students with the public are really useful. And it's important to recognise that the starting points of students and the public are quite different on free speech type issues, but not completely different. So this is from our culture war studies. We asked people, when thinking about each of the following issues, do you think that people in general should be feel free to say what they want about them, or that people should be careful not to offend others when talking about these types of issues? And we asked about a whole series of issues, but I'll just pick out three here. So on Brexit, the orange bar is people should feel free to say what they want. The blue is they should be careful not to offend. You can see the public tend to be more open to people saying what they want. So higher on Brexit in terms of people should feel free. Higher on climate change, that people should feel free to say what they want. Not masses of difference between the blue bar sizes between these. And on the British Empire, actually, less of a gap between young and old in terms of the orange bars or the blue bars on this. So young people, students, current undergraduate students today are quite different in their perspectives on free speech, but not an entirely different species on free speech concern, which is how it's often portrayed. There's a bit of difference there, and you can't tell whether that's a life cycle effect just because young people are always more cautious on those types of things, or whether it's a cohort effect. But we should be suspicious about the fact that portraying this as a completely new generation of snowflakes or social justice warriors within the current generation of undergraduates. Because when I look in the generational book, all the way back over the decades, the evidence shows a clear gaps between young and old on attitudes to race, immigration, gender equality, gender identity, sexuality, etc. But the key point is today we don't see unusual gaps on those types of issues between younger people and older people today. In fact, there's more or less a constant ratio, where the youngest generation are twice as likely to be comfortable with the changing social norm, the latest emerging social norm. So if you look back to the mid-1980s, when baby boomers were the youngest adult generation, and you look at things like whether women should stay at home, attitudes to whether women should stay at home and men should go out and do the work, baby boomers were half as likely to say that is the right way to think about society as the pre-war generation, so their parents and grandparents. But then you roll that forward to 2021 and you change the issue. Now baby boomers are the oldest adult generation, and you change the issue to something like pride in the British Empire. Gen Z are half as likely to say, the youngest adult generation are half as likely to say that you should be proud rather than ashamed of the British Empire. So the issues change, but the ratio between young and old stays the same. which is really important to bear in mind, that this is not a completely new and unusual relationship between young and old on these types of social issues. And one of the great benefits, actually, of having to study generational difference over the decades is you start to realise that's not just inevitable because of socialisation. When we are formed, we have different environments that we grew up in, so we have different norms that kind of stick with us. It's actually also beneficial for society, essential for society. There was a group of demographers in the 1950s who talked a lot about generational change, who called it a type of demographic metabolism that stops society becoming stale, turning into a stagnant pond. If you didn't have gaps between young and old on their attitudes to these types of things, we're probably not changing enough as a society. If young people think the same as older people, we're probably not moving forward enough. But we have to fight against that kind of constant sense. We keep forgetting that, as each generation of older people always forget that there's this gap between young and old. Thinking today's young are uniquely wrong or weird is an absolute constant of history. You can go through any type of era and you will see exactly the same sorts of patterns. So you can go back to Socrates. 400 BC, Socrates said, "The children now love luxury, they have bad manners, they show disrespect for their elders and love gossip in the place of activity." In a very long diatribe against young people of his day. That's just an excerpt from it. So we tested this actually in a polling thing with the public about young people today. We used Socrates' words and asked the general public in the UK today whether they agreed with that as a statement about young people today, and over half of them did. So this is like a real constant that we've still got this sort of sense young people are the worst ever, whatever era you're in. I like this one from 1771, a letter to the Town and Country magazine, talking about young people of that day, who called them a race of effeminate, self-admiring, emaciated fribbles, which is more or less a definition of snowflake, just 250 years before we had that as a term. So this is a constant. I think the truth is, it probably does feel more divided now between young and old, and you can go into more detail in this maybe in the discussion, but it's partly because of more fractious media, social media and politics that we have now that has put culture change and division at the heart of our politics in the way that we just haven't done in the past. And there's good evidence for this in all sorts of different ways. And first is there's a long-term shift in politics that's become more focused on cultural issues and division than economic promises. And there's some great work by Peter Hall, an academic who has and team who have studied 21 Western democracies' manifestos. So looking at the manifestos, the political promises from manifestos all the way back to 1950, and coded the different sorts of promises into whether they are cultural or economic, and tracked that over time. And you can see what's happened is we've got this massive increase in cultural-related promise. What sort of country do we want to be? Multiculturalism, immigration, all of those types of issues, policy issues, have gone shooting up, where economic promises have fallen away in political manifestos. So this is a long-term trend that we've seen, partly driven by global economy, where economic promises are harder to make at a national level, but partly driven with this focus on cultural issues across all sorts of different areas. That's been taken over in the UK by other things that have happened. And obviously in Brexit, Brexit was a lot to do with cultural issues and the types of country that we want to be, as much as or more than the economics. And then we have had this huge shift, dramatic shift in recent years, of focusing more on culture war type related issues. And you can see that in very simple ways. We did some, as part of these studies, the culture war studies, we didn't just do surveys of the public, we also did media content analysis. And this is the number of articles that we tracked that mentioned culture wars in other countries, in UK newspapers, but talking about culture wars that are happening in other countries outside of the UK. And it's mostly the US that people are talking about, yeah, the culture wars. And those little dots are US presidential elections. So we tend to peak in our interest in culture wars in the US around US presidential elections. But here's the line for culture wars of articles referencing the UK. You can see for many, many years, we didn't really talk about culture wars in the UK, nothing like we did in the US. And then just in the last few years, shot up. So in 2015, there was 21 articles in all UK newspapers about culture wars in the UK. And by 2021, there was 1,500 articles a year about culture wars in the UK. But even that is dwarfed by more tabloid-friendly type issues like cancel culture. So this is the line for culture wars, goes up to there to 1,500. This is the line for cancel culture, which really didn't exist at all as a concept or issue up until 2018, 19. And now we've got 3,600 articles talking about cancel culture in the UK. So this is really important, that we've changed this narrative. We've imported wholesale a US narrative around culture wars in the UK. And it's no surprise then that awareness of these terms has increased significantly in the survey of the public. So this is awareness. Do people know a lot, a little, very little, or have never heard of different terms? And you can see half of people had never heard of cancel culture back in 2020. And now you've got 38%, 4 in 10 people saying they know a lot about cancel culture in a very short period of time, kind of socially. And same with being woke. Woke has become the new, one of the newer versions of this. It's a particular focus of, in politics and media discussion of this. And big, big increases in people awareness of terms like woke, which has become the new dividing line in many ways, woke versus anti-woke. So there's a lot of discussion in the academic literature about US culture wars, about the extent to which culture wars are a bottom-up or a top-down phenomenon. Is it driven by people themselves who are worried about culture change and want to push back on aspects of culture change, or is it set from above by the elite, political or media elites, who kind of set the tone for the narrative? And obviously, in the end, it's a bit of both. But this type of change, that type of media change, has to have an effect on people, how they consider these types of issues when it's being pushed quite so much at them. And it's really important to bear that in mind when we're talking about free speech in universities specifically. It also means that this is such a dynamic environment where the meaning of words and the meaning of terms is changing really quickly. So the meaning of woke is changing in real time. So we asked the public, if someone describes you as woke, would you consider it a compliment or an insult? And I'm going to do a show of hands here with you, just to see, just have a quick test. So if someone described you as woke, would you consider it a compliment first? Hands up if you consider it a compliment. There's a few reticent hands here. There's a few. Oh, there's a very strong positive hand from Rachel at the front. There's kind of a smattering of hands, I'd say about 20% of people. And who would consider it an insult? That's a very strong hand there, very strong hand. There's more insult than compliment. And I can understand why people who didn't put their hands up didn't put their hand up, because it really depends on how it's being used, I would imagine. So it can be a compliment, can be an insult, depending on how it's used. The reality is it's increasingly used as an insult for people, which is why you're more emphatic. And that's emphatic on that. And that's what we see in the findings. So when we first asked this in 2020, half of people didn't know what the hell we were talking about with woke, and a quarter thought it was an insult, a quarter thought it was a compliment. But you can see the insult is increasing. 36% of people now think it's an insult. Compliment hasn't changed very much, and you can kind of get an idea of that because it's become more political. You look at the divides between different groups. So Labour supporters, much more likely to think it's a compliment. Conservative supporters, much more likely to think it's an insult, and have moved a long, long way, which is another indication that the media content, because they'll be seeing different media content, is affecting people. So 55, the majority of Conservative supporters now think it's an insult. Big change in a short period of years. And then when you look at it by age, incredible gradient between young and old on this. And the big movers are older groups moving towards insult. Not so much young people moving away from compliment, but older people moving towards insult, which is, again, understandable given the tone and focus of how it's been used. We do actually have a new study on culture wars coming out, and I can't, unfortunately, give you the actual data because it's embargoed until next couple of weeks, but we'll have it out in October and November. And just a quick sneak peek, then do have a look at the Policy Institute website to pick this up. So the awareness of the terms continues to increase, no surprise there, given the enormous amount of coverage. Woke is now even more of an insult for people outside of young people. Young people is softening a little bit with young people, but it's still holding on to the idea that it's a compliment. Even worse, for me at least, is that anti-woke has started to take hold as an identity for some. It's a minority, but it's very concentrated among particular groups, including older people. So woke versus anti-woke, which sounds so clumsy and reductive, is actually starting to take hold among different groups. People, though, maybe more encouragingly, are increasingly thinking that politicians are stirring up culture wars, big shifts in that type of tracking that we've been doing. So people are kind of seeing that, is this real or is it for other purposes, which is probably a good sign. But then maybe the most depressing bit is completely off subject, but just as a interesting aside, is Andrew Tate is appealing to a depressingly significant minority of Gen Z men. This has been seen in other work that people have done, but we're just unpicking it a bit more with some think tank people and politicians on this. And that is a thing that we will be looking at more. So look out for those. We'll be putting those out as different sorts of releases. But back to a bit of a detour into Andrew Tate, back to free speech in universities. So if I was trying to sum it up as well as I could from all that type of evidence, I would say that the challenge to free speech in universities is often either overstated or too readily dismissed, when the reality is it's not nearly as bad as it's often made out, and there are these wider drivers of change in culture wars that are affecting that people often ignore when we're trying to interpret what's happening in universities. But you really can't separate universities from society in that sort of way. But, and it is a big but, there is enough of a signal in the trends to suggest that positive interventions to support free speech in universities should be a focus. Those changes are not entirely invented. There is something happening there that means that we should be taking this issue seriously and trying to bolster it. And the Free Speech Act, which was discussed a lot last week and previous week, is an important part of that response. But just to show you more from a survey perspective, we did ask students whether they'd heard of it. And not surprisingly, 45% of people said no, not at all, we're not looking out for that type of thing. But we did have a third of students who had heard of it. And more importantly, there was quite reasonable levels of support for it. So you've got two-thirds of people, 6 and 10, kind of people among both the public and students who say, actually, I strongly support it or tend to support it. After we gave a description of it that we tried to make as neutral and fair as possible. And you can have a look at how we asked that. You have to be careful. I'm a survey methodologist by background, and you have to be careful of what we call pseudo-opinions when you're asking people about quite technical things. There's lots of great survey experiments that ask people about fictitious acts that a large proportion of the people are very willing to give you an opinion on, things that are completely made up, like the Public Affairs Act, or my favourite, the Metallic Metals Act, people had a view on. So you've got to be aware that you often get a third of people saying things on completely made up things. But I would also point out that we get this level of support for a government initiative, for an unpopular government among this kind of student body. Plus, there is support for the individual elements that we also measured within the Act. So there is a bit of appetite here, I would interpret this as, from both students and from the general public, for something to be done in this sort of space. But again, as we touched on in previous lectures, implementation is going to face a really tricky terrain in this. And I think, in some ways, this is the most important slide in the whole of the slide deck. Because it's so related to content, context, and then impact. understanding what the effects on free speech are is, and what we should be doing about it, what the drivers of problems with free speech, I think, is summed up a little bit in this type of question. So we ask people, to what extent you agree or disagree, it's important for universities to allow for all ideas and opinions to be expressed, and then we qualified it in different sorts of ways. So that all sides of the debate can be heard to enable free and open inquiry, nearly everyone will agree with that. Nearly all students will agree that that's the case. Then if you add qualifiers like even if they are immoral, even if the ideas are immoral, that affects support quite significantly. You've got large increases in disagreeing with that as an approach, that all ideas should be expressed even if they're immoral or they're factually incorrect. That hits people a lot. But the real things that affect people's support, the biggest effects on people's support, is if you add the qualifier, even if this means some students feel threatened, or if this means some students feel unsafe. And then support for free and open inquiry drops really significantly, and you've got relatively few people agreeing with that is the case. And the reason I think this slide is important is because the gap that I've missed out further up the chart is for offence, even if this means students being offended. And that affects support for free and open inquiry much less than feelings of threat or feelings of unsafeness among students. So this is not just about people taking offence. This is the lesson that I take from this. This is not about students being worried about or being eager to be offended by lots of different things. This is about this really difficult space between offence, threat, and safety. And that's the difficulty that the Act is going to have in unpicking these different elements, because the boundaries between those are not entirely clear and related to content, context, and impact on the individual. It's going to be a difficult thing to unpick. And then maybe the key message of one of the key messages from our research and the work that we've been doing it on this is that it shouldn't just be about regulation. There is widespread support for a range of more positive measures to support free speech among different groups, including students. So this is four key types of support, whether we ask people whether they'd be effective. And it's the kind of broad support, broad types are training on the top one, contact initiatives in the middle one, so bringing divided sides together, discussion guidelines and rules in the third one, and then codes of conduct in the fourth one. And we actually did a bit of work on what we could do positively to support free speech in universities in this, our latest report, that picked up on those four themes. So this just came out in September. This is much more of a policy report and practice report than it is a research report, and it's recommendations that we have. And we did a review of all the literature we could find on different sorts of interventions to support free speech in universities. And really, it just boils down to those four groups of activities, as far as we can see. So you have things like classroom discussion guidelines, and geography is an aspect of that. So what's been shown in some work is co-creating discussion guidelines can help with disagreeing well and classroom civility. We asked about these in the qualitative research that we did with students, and there was support for all of these, but there was also recognition that lecturers do their best to create a safe space already, but it doesn't stop judgment of you outside the classroom as well. So it's not just something you can sort out in the classroom, which is where contact initiatives come in, which are opportunities for polarised groups to come together outside of classrooms to discuss divisive issues. And there's many examples of those across different universities, bridging divides, community of inquiry, the project on civil discourse, all at different universities. And the key point here, from a student's perspective, is it only works if people come, and only certain people will come to those types of initiatives, which is also a problem. Which relates to the third one, which again is a group of things that come up a lot in individual university programs, which is listening training and coaching effectively. So training staff and students on active listening can help people feel more comfortable expressing their views. And there's many examples of them: reflective structured dialogue, deep listening, those types of things, lots of things that we talk about more in the report. And I like this quote from one of the students: humanity progresses when people learn how to actually listen to someone and build on what they're saying and have a civilized debate. And that's effectively the crux of that. That's the idea, is that's how that works. And then finally, codes of conduct. Also commonly used, university-wide agreed and communicated codes of conduct on free speech. Chicago principles are probably the most famous of those, which have been adopted by 99 other US universities. Lots of versions of that around the world, including King's. The student, from a student perspective, the key point that the students were making to us about this is it needs to be coached in. Behaviour that's modelled. You can't just have a code of conduct and then think that's sorted. It needs to be modelled from the very first contact that people have with it. And I was lucky enough with our principal and president to go on a visit to University of Chicago for a project that we do jointly with University of Melbourne on free speech. And it was really useful to see how Chicago employ those types of techniques from the very beginning, from the summer schools, from the very first lessons that people have, very first contact that people have, free speech is embedded within that. But I think it's fair to say, even from a Chicago perspective, we honestly don't really know what works in this, not a full picture of what works and what works best. So taking Chicago as an example, it's so deeply embedded in the University of Chicago, it's difficult to understand what helps most from all the different activities that they undertake or whether it helps at all. And they also attract a particularly motivated set of students who are focused on free speech because they've got such a reputation for protecting free speech over the decades. So it's very difficult to understand. So these are the two main recommendations for the report, from the report. The first is that individual, isolated initiatives on free speech are unlikely to achieve lasting impacts. They're all good things to do, but because the challenge cuts across different activities and environments, it's really difficult to make it land in a university as a whole if you just treat it as individual aspects. So what we've suggested is that we need to develop a clear theory of change, which is what we use in evaluation terms, where you work out your inputs and activities, how that's going to flow to outputs and outcomes and impact over time. You work out a clear theory of what leads to what, and then you test it. So implement a program of testing to understand how each action contributes or doesn't to supporting free speech in universities. And you may have heard of things called the What Works Center network. There's lots of these institutions that government and others have set up that try to understand what actually works in different policy environments. And it's taking that type of approach. We're asking for that to be implemented. And then the second recommendation follows from the fact that we need to recognise the highly charged and polarised environment in which this new legislation is going to be operating. So we need to be particularly cautious in how and when legal measures are employed, as fractious, high-profile court cases may themselves shape perceptions and encourage division rather than improve outcomes on free speech. And this is my very final slide, because it relates to reflections on the previous two lectures, which I was lucky enough to see or read. So great contribution, Professor Arif Ahmed. And he was compelling, I think, on how the main objective is to protect the weak in this free speech debate, that it may seem inconvenient at times, but the reality is we need those types of buttressing, not just for now, but for the future, when it could be the weak that are getting picked up. And he was also convincing on free speech as a process value, which I really agree with. So this is about how we do things, which is why, for me, though, that we need to look at the full impact of our actions when we're trying to protect free speech, including any unintended consequences of trying to support it, where fractious legal challenges can themselves lead to greater division. And not only that, be seen and used as tools by motivated actors to get that type of outcome from that. And we need to be very cautious of that. It was interesting when Arif said words are not a type of violence, they are alternative violence. That was a really important point and was picked up in some of the questioning for people. And I think that points to the really difficult area here where offence, threat and harm are challenging to fully delineate. And that reflected a lot of what David Rubin was saying in the first lecture, that the law is not always clear on these types of things. It needs to be tested. Thresholds need to be tested. That will be essential to this. But that itself can be divisive and should be used really sparingly if we're not wanting to make things worse in an unintended way. So to sum up, just from me, there's only three points I think you want to make in this kind of area, is to really recognise that this is not a neutral space when we're talking about interventions and actions. In fact, it's about as far from a neutral space as you can get in these types of policy debates, which means that the way we act is as important as what we're trying to achieve. We need to bear that in mind, that the process value of this is really central to this. And everything that we do needs to reinforce the outcome that we want to do, not just in its endpoint, but in how we conduct ourselves. So if we're really interested in bolstering free speech in universities, rather than as another front in a culture war, we need to focus as much on positive support as regulation and law. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.